Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Young, it's Here and Now. The mayor of New Orleans has authorized the forcible evacuations of the 10,000 or so people still remaining in the city. But so far, police on the ground say force will only be used as a last resort. The international community is responding to Hurricane Katrina, with many saying they're just waiting for callbacks from the U.S. South Korea has promised $30 million, but says 100 tons of blankets and diapers will be delayed till next week while they await further word from the U.S. A top Indian official reportedly says his country has a plane loaded with medicine parked at the airport, waiting for a response from the U.S. At a Pentagon press conference today, Lieutenant General Eng of the U.S. Northern Command acknowledged help from outside the U.S.
The Canadians have divers in the water off Pascagoula, Mississippi, helping with harbor reconstruction, and Mexico will have a vessel arrive today that will join the Bataan in the Gulf and begin search and rescue.
Meanwhile, the economic impact of Hurricane Katrina is becoming clearer. The Congressional Budget Office, which is the nonpartisan research arm of Congress, said today that the storm would have significant but not overwhelming effect on the national economy, and it would cost 400,000 jobs. Joining us on the line is Douglas Holtz Aiken. He's director of the Congressional Budget Office, or CBO. And Doug, we welcome you as always.
Good to be here again.
Your quote, significant but not overwhelming. What do you mean by that?
It's important to try to get magnitudes squared away in a situation like this. I mean, the first and foremost consideration is the people. And for the people and for the city of New Orleans, this is a devastating event. For an economy the size of the United States, it is not. It will slow growth late in 2005, but in one of the perverse features of any disaster recovery, as the building takes place and as the rebuilding ensues, it will actually contribute to economic growth. So we will see an economy that doesn't teeter into recession. It'll grow more slowly and then pick up next year.
Actually, we should note there's a sort of a little sidebar to that that you just mentioned. We're now hearing that the federal government plans to distribute debit cards worth about $2,000 each to victims of Hurricane Katrina, a very small amount, but they will be spending that.
Certainly, the foremost consideration at the moment is the people. Mm-hmm. And what is typical in these situations is there's a big profile that says up front the people are displaced, relief is necessary, this is one form of that, and then they can come back, they begin to rebuild, and the hiring and the building contributes to the regional economy and the national economy. Well, the difficulty here is that profile is going to be stretched out by the flooding in New Orleans, and there's an enormous amount we just don't know.
Well, we understand, too, that last week you and others thought that there might be larger economic consequences, but you seem, if I'm reading some of your quotes correctly, you seem encouraged by the way refineries and pipelines are being worked on.
The economic impacts come in regional form. Certainly the direct loss of employment in the states that are affected is an important consideration. But for the national impact, the biggest areas are energy prices and shipping through the Mississippi. We have, in fact, been monitoring the recovery of the refining and the oil production facilities, and it has come back faster than was initially feared that would be able to come back. So that is encouraging.
What about the job losses that you mentioned? Are they going to be localized? In New Orleans, a city of 500,000, you're saying 400,000 jobs will be lost. I'm assuming, do you mean along the coast, or do you mean it'll trickle further inland?
Again, we have an enormous range of uncertainty about the exact number, but the way we thought about the problem was to look at the SMSAs that would be most dramatically affected, New Orleans and Gulfport, places like that, look at the number of employees there, try to get a handle on the direct job loss, think then about slower economic growth in the area and how slowly those jobs would come back, and a ballpark estimate is we're down nearly 500,000 jobs at the end of 2005. Importantly, past that, one would expect those jobs to come back and ultimately reach full employment in the region again.
Well, Douglas Holtz Aiken of the CBO, relief efforts are costing the federal government $2 billion a day. The final price tag, we hear, could reach $200 billion. Insurance losses already roughly equal to the $32.5 billion that insurers paid after 9/11. This month, Congress was expected to make $35 billion worth of cuts in defense and health care spending and to make some tax cuts permanent. You are with the Congressional Budget Office. You often have a message that the White House doesn't want to hear. Do you think those cuts should be made permanent? What do you think should happen?
I think it's important to revisit the basic budget plan that the Congress outlined at the beginning of the year, which included some cuts in mandatory spending for particular entitlement programs and also had provisions for lower receipts in the form of tax cuts of different types. This changes the near-term budgetary picture. It will change it as dramatically as the Congress chooses to change it. Most of the impacts will be what they choose to pass. Longer term, the same budget picture prevails today that prevailed at the beginning of the year. The daunting problems in the federal budget are Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, and the growth of those programs. So while it's sensible to revisit the basic picture right now, it's important for Congress to come back to the basic business over the long term as well.
So perhaps those tax cuts might be put on hold, although some are suggesting tax cuts for hurricane victims. So we'll see how that plays out. Douglas Holtz Aiken, Director of the Congressional Budget Office, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Well, much of the focus in the aftermath of Katrina has been on New Orleans, but parishes around the city are just now being heard from. Boston Globe reporter Kevin Cullen traveled to Washington Parish, just north of New Orleans, where a Massachusetts sheriff has come to help. And Kevin's on the line. First of all, Kevin, what did you see in that parish?
The destruction of Katrina, particularly on the north shore of Pontchartrain, Lake Pontchartrain, is extraordinary. And I drove up there yesterday, and it was just awe-inspiring to see the power of nature, to see 100-year-old trees just ripped, snapped in half like matchsticks. And this was for 60 or 70 miles that I drove, and it just was as far as the eyes could see. It appeared almost as if a giant scythe had been leveled right across these forests, and just they were cut in half. Mm.
And I know you're at the communication center when you happen to pick up a conversation that that caught your ear.
Yeah, there's a state senator named Ben Nevers. Ben Nevers was in there complaining about the federal response, which we've heard all week from local folk and local authorities. And then I just heard him say to somebody, if it wasn't for those boys from Massachusetts, we still wouldn't have contact with the outside world.
And now who is this?
This is Jimmy DeFeola, the sheriff of Middlesex County. Jimmy told me, the sheriff, he said he was just sitting in his house in Malden on Friday morning at 5 a.m. watching CNN.
That's here in Massachusetts.
Yeah, in Massachusetts. And he saw Ray Nagin, the mayor of New Orleans, with, you know, tears in his eyes, begging for people to help, and the frustration in the mayor's voice. And he said, it was an SOS. And the sheriff said, he just said, the heck with it. And he's his own boss. So he started calling people, calling his deputies, and said, come on, let's go. We got to go. And in 5 hours, they had put together an 8-car caravan, the most important part of it being this 1.2 million rolling mobile command center with a 40-foot satellite tower. Because, you know, for 6 days, this whole section of Louisiana was 40. They didn't have any cell phones. They don't have any regular phones. They still don't have any phones or cell coverage. And for 6 days, they were cut off from the rest of the outside world. I talked with Toy Taylor, who's the parish president. He said, he told me that on Sunday morning, he got down on his knees. He was staying in Ben Nevers' house because he had no place to stay, and he begged and he pleaded with God to send somebody, anybody, to his parish. And when he drove up, you know, he drove about 10 miles from the house, and he turned up this dirt road where the command center, and he saw this thing. He said it looked like it was out of Star Wars, a big satellite tower. And he's a little wiry guy, but he ran over to Jimmy, who's a very big guy, Sheriff DePaola, and just grabbed him and hugged him. And Jimmy said it was so tight he couldn't breathe for a second.
Yeah. So Kevin Cullen of the Boston Globe, you're telling us that there's a whole parish, like, as we understand it, a county, outside of New Orleans, completely cut off for 6 days, and a sheriff and his deputies from Massachusetts drove in with their satellite truck.
Yep, that's it was like sort of like out of the old west, you know. The cavalry arrived, and they couldn't do it. I mean, they had no interoperability, so the cops couldn't communicate with each other. The ambulances couldn't communicate with each other. There was no communication in this area. So, they know several people died because they just didn't get to them. There was no way to get to them. And then all of a sudden, these guys arrive with this high-tech, state-of-the-art mobile command center, and now they have interoperability. They can talk to each other. They've had medical evacuations. They've saved lives where people would have died because they just wouldn't have got. And these are routine calls. You know, these are 70-year-old ladies with breathing problems.
But this isn't, I mean, the Paris that you're talking about normally wouldn't think of itself as isolated or, I mean, this
is no, it's 100 miles from the, it's 100 miles from the state capital. But, you know, for 2 days, they could not, the people that are in charge of emergency relief up there were huddled in the fire station there, and they were surrounded by so many fallen trees, they couldn't get out for 2 days. And after 2 days, Toy Taylor, the president of Paris, told me he wrote a single-page letter in his hand, his own hand, and handed it to a couple of National Guard soldiers who got in a Jeep and then picked their way, cleared the debris as they went on, and a trip that would normally take about 2 hours took them over 6 hours to get to Baton Rouge. They handed the letter to the, you know, the appropriate authorities that were running the entire relief effort and said, please come and help us. And nothing happened. They had no communication, no support, nothing from the outside world until these guys from Massachusetts just drove in from nowhere.
So, Kevin, what I'm hearing you say is that we have yet to really understand how widespread the need for help is.
Oh, I think that's true, and I think it's because, like I said, naturally we have focused on New Orleans. But, I mean, I tried to get down into Slidell on the north shore of Pontchartrain. Yes, it is impossible to even get to. And the sort of the stretch between Gulfport in Mississippi and the east shore of Pontchartrain, there haven't been a lot of reporters there because it's just impossible to get to. So I don't think we know. The one thing it did become clear to me, Robin, yesterday is I remember that within a few days or at least a week or so in 9/11, they had more help than they could need. You know, the help was coming from all over the country, and they said, we don't need any more help. You're getting in the way.
Right.
I don't think that's going to happen here. I mean, I think you could empty out every law enforcement agency in New England, send them down here, and there'd be plenty for them to do. You know, it's really hard to explain what it means to people who are so isolated in this little small corner of Louisiana to have, you know, help come from the outside world, you know, just show up. And particularly from a place like Massachusetts. There are also ambulance drivers from Chicago who just showed up like a day after the Massachusetts guys. And it really, as Toy Taylor and just some ordinary people who were driving up, dropping off diapers. These people don't even have houses, and they were dropping off diapers that they had bought at a Walmart, like a 50-mile drive away. So, I mean, people are feeding off each other down here. The southern folk are feeding off the northerners just showing up. And the northerners, I think, are feeding off. This is a special breed of folk down here. What it meant to them to see that people had arrived from different parts of the country. I mean, it sounds corny, but, you know, it's like we're all Americans.
Kevin Cullen, reporter for the Boston Globe. Kevin, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
And just ahead, some Duke University students who also just wanted to help out in New Orleans and what they had to do to get there. Also later in the program, the pictures of Hurricane Katrina. There's more coming up here and now. Young, it's here and now. Non-governmental disaster experts have been calling for a system to be set up that would allow competent volunteers to respond to Hurricane Katrina. As we just heard, a sheriff from Massachusetts and ambulance drivers from Chicago took things into their own hands, as did Sonny Bird, a sophomore at Duke University. He and two friends had just returned from a road trip to New Orleans, and he's on the line. And, Sonny, I first want to get to what prompted that trip. We understand you were watching television last Thursday when many Americans were having a powerful reaction to what they were seeing. What was yours?
I was just completely awed by the fact that there were 20 to 25,000 people trapped in the New Orleans Convention Center and that they had been there for 4 or 5 days with no food, water, or and very little military presence. I just knew that there was something that could be done about that.
What'd you do?
I contacted my roommate, and I asked him if he wanted to make a long weekend trip to New Orleans. And we found another friend down the hall, and we got in my Hyundai Elantra, and we started driving.
And drove for hours. You also had loaded up the car with bottles of water, we understand, topped the tank off, and headed for New Orleans. And found it wasn't easy to get in. How did you get into New Orleans?
Well, the first tack that we took was just to try every highway. We located a map of New Orleans, and we tried Highway 10, Highway 55, Highway 63, Highway 90. All of them were blocked by either physical barriers or a military blockade. And so we spent the rest of that day in Baton Rouge working at a local news station with refugee supplies, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And we came up with the idea that the only way that we could get into the city to help the people out would be to pose as members of the press or news reporters, because those were the only people allowed in the city, was the press.
What'd you do?
I stole an Associated Press pass from the news station, and we temporarily borrowed a news shirt. And my friend went to a copy center and made copies of the press passes for each of us with our names on them. He made a business card in case the National Guard asked questions about our motives, and we drove to the city, and we pulled up to the National Guard blockade, and they flagged us aside, obviously, because we were in a civilian car. We held up our press passes, and they bought it, and they waved us through.
I want to talk about what you did once you were in there, but... you know, as a member of the press, you know, I have to ask you, do you feel any pangs of guilt about, you know, impersonating a journalist? Because, of course, now people are going to look closer at real journalists. Or do you think it was justified by the fact that you wanted to get into help?
We all three of us feel guilty, and all three of us are absolutely convinced that it was our last resort. We tried everything, and we are very sad that it had to come down to that, that the only way that we could help people was to lie and to be fraudulent and to do some things that were perhaps illegal. We do feel bad about that, but it was what had to be done to get people out of that convention center.
Many of the people, you know, were beginning to leave, but what'd you find there?
First thing that was just absolutely mind-boggling was that it was incredibly easy to get to. It was very accessible. We just drove right up to it within 20 minutes in my little car. I mean, we just pulled right up to it. There was no Katrina damage that was restricting the people inside that building.
It's one thing to see something on television, but when you actually could smell and see it, what were your thoughts?
It was just an absolute nightmare, and all we could think, the phrase that kept running through our minds was, how could people have been here for 4 or 5 days? It was incredibly hot. The place was just trashed. There was feces, urine everywhere. The smell was unbearable. I mean, the guards and ourselves, we had our shirts over our face. The second and third floors of the building were filled with dead bodies. We were not able to access those floors because they weren't secured by the military. The place was just unbearable.
Well, I understand that when you first got to New Orleans, you passed a 15-year-old boy who was sitting on the side of the road holding a sign that said, need water and food, and you gave him a little water. After you went to the convention center, you headed back his way?
That boy's name was Mario. We headed back towards Mario on he was on Magazine Street, and we told him that we were on our way to Baton Rouge. And keep in mind, at this point, it was about 7 p.m., so the sun was really setting fast, and the place is just incredibly dangerous at night. We had seen some people on the street earlier, and they said, "Do not be here when the sun sets." So we were looking to get out of the city. We asked Mario, we said, we can take you, we can take your family. He had a grandfather that was in need of insulin, and they said no, they refused to leave. They said they're waiting on supplies from the Red Cross, they're waiting on supplies from the military. So we asked them where some other people were that we could help, and he said right around the corner. We drove around the corner, we stopped my car in the middle of the street, and we opened all of our doors, and people just flocked to the vehicle. Probably about 10 to 15 people just came walking out to us. We explained to them that we were college students, we had driven a long way, and we just want to help them get out of the city. And so there was one man, an older man, his name was Jesse, and he was in need of immediate attention. He had been attacked all over his body by fire ants while he was in a tree up above floodwater. So we immediately put him in the back of the car, and then we took three women. So then we hit the road, left the city, and went back to Baton Rouge. At that point, it was dark.
You took the gentleman who'd been attacked by fire ants to the LSU Medical Center. You took the women to dinner, and they later found shelter with relatives. And then I understand you went back?
Because the three women that we took, two of them had husbands that we had left behind because we didn't have room for them. And so we got up at 6:30 that next morning, and we drove back to the city. We had a little bit more trouble getting through the National Guard blockade this time, and we went back to the exact same place, and we rounded up the wives' husbands, and we found another man who was looking to get out of the city. And we put the three of them in the back seat and the three of us in the front, and we left the city again bound for Baton Rouge.
Speaking on behalf of the officials, can you understand that you might have been seen as a threat to security, but not as opposed to someone who was going to help out? That they can't know, they can't tell the difference.
I just can't see that, because the circumstances were so dire that I just cannot see the logic in rejecting help from any facet. People were just stranded in there like animals, and nobody was getting to them. And the only reason why nobody was getting to them is because nobody was allowed to.
Sonny Bird, a sophomore at Duke University, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for him. Robin Young, it's here and now. Powerful Washington lawmakers and ordinary citizens are paying their last respects to Supreme Court Chief Justice William Rehnquist. President Bush and Justice Sandra Day O'Connor will pay tribute to the late Chief Justice at services today. Then Rehnquist will be buried at Arlington National Cemetery, closing a chapter in court history, but leaving many questions about the next court, which begins its session in less than a month. Joining us on the line from Washington is Warren Ritchie, who covers the Supreme Court for the Christian Science Monitor. And Warren, eyes are now turning to Judge John Roberts, renominated by President Bush to succeed the late William Rehnquist. Do most people in Washington expect that Judge Roberts will be confirmed easily?
Well, I think many people in Washington believe he will be confirmed. I don't know how easy it will be. Mm-hmm. But I do think I think there is that expectation, and I think you saw example of it from the White House choosing him to replace the Chief Justice. I think that was the White House reading the situation in that way and turning to him when this sudden situation arose.
You know, before we leave that topic, though, many Democrats are saying they're going to make tougher demands for documents that they haven't yet received, and they're going to ratchet it up a bit. But you think in the long run he will be confirmed?
Well, I don't know that he'll be confirmed. I do know that now that he's nominated for the chief spot, there will be more pointed questions, and I think that there will be perhaps more heated interrogation. I don't know how that will play out. It's just difficult to know what's going to happen down the road. One interesting thing is there has been some polling. Gallup did some polling that shows Judge Roberts at about 52% of respondents saying that they favor a yes vote in his nomination. And that's close to two other nominees, Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Clarence Thomas. They were both at 52 and 53% approval rating about at the same time. One nominee who was different was Robert Bork. He was only at 38% at this point, and with 35% of respondents saying that they would not support his nomination. So in terms of the numbers in public polling, now granted, members of the public don't have a vote. These are senators who are voting. But as a rough measure, it would appear that Roberts is in a similar position as Ruth Bader Ginsburg and Clarence Thomas. And the reason I mention this is because going into the Clarence Thomas hearings, it looked pretty good for him. And as we all know, those hearings developed into something quite important, and his confirmation wasn't at all clear.
Keep that in mind. Well, now President Bush is expected to pick a nominee to succeed Sandra Day O'Connor. Is there any sense that his timing or his decision will be in any way affected by the ongoing hurricane relief efforts and some criticism of those efforts?
Well, there are those who say that because the president is facing challenges, a number of challenges politically, and that his own approval rating is so low that he's going to need to play it safe and avoid a confrontation.
Somebody who's perhaps less of an ideologue?
Well, somebody who won't result in a big fight in the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And there are those who say that by naming Roberts to be chief rather than, for example, Antonin Scalia, Justice Scalia, that this is an indication that the president just wasn't up to it politically.
Well, I want to mention in a cabinet meeting yesterday, President Bush joked about nominating Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. He said that the list of candidates is wide open, which should create some good speculation here in Washington. And he said, I want to make sure you notice when I said that, I looked right at Al Gonzalez, who can really create speculation. to remind us why.
Yes, and well, because there was a great deal of speculation. In fact, it was more than speculation. The White House floated Attorney General Gonzalez's name the last time around, and there was an enormous outcry from the right that Alberto Gonzalez was not conservative enough, and ultimately the White House chose John Roberts. It's difficult to know whether the president was just joking. I mean, apparently he was joking. Mm-hmm. It's difficult to know how high on the president's list the attorney general is.
Well, briefly, who else do you think is on the list? Some people want there to be a woman on the list.
Yes. And, you know, we know the general list. What we don't know is who he's going to select. It'll either come down to a conservative nominee or a centrist moderate nominee, and what one way that I think about this is if it was a centrist, more moderate nominee like Senator Day O'Connor, it would be to the president's advantage and to John Roberts' advantage to announce it now. Because it would eliminate speculation about the court moving to the right. That would be off the table.
Right.
But if it is the intention of the White House to move the court to the right, in other words, to appoint someone who is more in the mold of Justice Scalia or Thomas, and thus move the court to the right of where Justice O'Connor is, then it would be advantageous to not say anything until Roberts is already confirmed.
Well, Warren Ritchie, in the meantime, we have a question, and in the minute that we have with you, we wonder if you have the answer. There's, of course, the chance that Sandra Day O'Connor will still return to the bench when John Roberts is Chief Justice because there will not be a new justice in place in October when the new session starts. So what happens if O'Connor then resigns when her replacement does take the bench? And O'Connor may have heard arguments in some cases, but her replacement didn't. And we have to be brief here.
Yes. Well, the key thing is, will she be a justice when the opinion is ready to issue? She may well be on the court at the time that the case is argued, and she may even participate in the vote, and she may be the decisive vote. But if there is a replacement for O'Connor who is confirmed, she would then cease to be a justice at the time that the case is that decision is handed down. Her vote would not count, which would result in a 5-4 case, in a 4-4 tie, mm-hmm. which means that decision would either need to be reheard. That case would either need to be re-argued with the new justice sitting in, or the existing lower court decision would stand.
It could get complicated, this is what you're saying. Warren Ritchie covers the Supreme Court for the Christian Science Monitor. Warren, thank you as always.
Thank you.
And we want to give you this note about a story we told you about yesterday. State officials are at the ready in Massachusetts should any evacuees from Hurricane Katrina show up, but so far no one has. And federal management officials informed the state that many of the survivors want to remain closer to their homes may not be coming here. We'll follow the story. Well, thousands of students displaced by Hurricane Katrina are enrolling in schools in the Houston area today. Jim Shule is Chief Information Officer for the Harris County Department of Education in Houston, where school has already been in session for a couple of weeks. And Jim, first of all, how many students displaced by Katrina are you taking in there in Houston?
We're expecting to enroll 4,000 students in the next 3 days.
Oh, boy. 3 days to get 4,000 students to school?
Well, you know, we are doing what we have to do, and the HISD, or Houston ISD, has done a wonderful job of coordinating registration, which is taking place as we speak, arranging transportation for those students, and they'll be loading on buses and taking to campuses with space available. Mm-hmm. They've also made three campuses, opened up three additional campuses that were previously closed to help educate those children, make room for them.
Where do you get the books and the teachers?
Well, we're scrambling. We are hiring teachers. Some of the teachers are coming from Louisiana. They had teachers there. Mm-hmm. I believe temporary certifications will be issued for those teachers so they can start teaching the students that are coming from the Katrina Education Relief. Mm-hmm. But system-wide here, we are looking at somewhere between 10 and 20,000 students. Those official numbers will come in as school districts are enrolling students and reporting that to their service centers.
Well, in fact, according to today's Houston Chronicle, I'm sure you're well aware, the Texas Education Commissioner said there may be as many as 70,000 displaced students eventually enrolling in Texas schools this fall. You know, people want to help. Texas is getting a big gold star. But are people also bracing? How's the money situation?
Well, again, you know, those questions are heading to the Texas Education Agency at this time. We've gotten some wonderful support from the Texas Education Agency, is guaranteeing us that, you know, some of the financial burdens that will be taken on by the schools will be taken care of.
Some reported estimates put the possible cost at $60 million.
That's probably, just for education, that's probably not enough money. We'll find out. You know, each student costs us on the average of over $5,000 per student per year. So you start to put the numbers to it. When the final numbers come in, there'll be lots of costs associated with that.
It's a generous thing that Texas is doing. It's also required by law to, you know, all homeless children have to be given an education.
That's correct. And these children will be classified as homeless and will be eligible for free and reduced lunch or the lunch program. So what our goal is to get them enrolled, get them some normalcy in their life, feed them, house them during the day, and, this will enable the parents to go find jobs or work and those kinds of things.
Jim Shule, Chief Information Officer for the Harris County Department of Education in Houston, welcoming the displaced students from the Louisiana area. Jim, thank you, and good luck to you.
Well, thank you very much. And if you're in out there listening, we can certainly take school supplies and things like that.
What kind of help are you getting? What kind of donations are you getting?
You know, I had a ballet company drive 13 hours from Albuquerque, New Mexico, yesterday to drop off school supplies. We had a donor that had a closed business that gave us 3,000 backpacks. So we're loading up the backpacks with school supplies. I have a truck reportedly coming from Minnesota with 8,000 backpacks in it, which we'll distribute across the state or as needed. I think it was OfficeMax yesterday. You know, they dropped 6 pallets of school supplies here at HCD yesterday, and we're expecting 4 to 6 more from them. So they've been doing a wonderful job. So we're getting wonderful contributions from many, many companies.
Well, Jim Shule of the Harris County Department of Education in Houston. For a link, if you'd like to help as well, go to our website, here-now.org. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Of Vinyang, it's here and now. The devastation of Hurricane Katrina has been captured in a wealth of photographs, images that have attempted to define the unimaginable. Will one come to symbolize the disaster in years to come? Joining us on the line now, Donald Winslow. He's editor of News Photographer magazine. Don, thanks for your time.
You're welcome.
And question to you, what pictures have stood out for you?
Well, I think the early photographs out from when the storm was hitting, there was a photograph of a man knee-deep trudging through the water with a plastic bag and his belongings, and people on the roofs of cars as the water was rising. And in particular, there was a photograph by a University of Texas student named Ben Sklar, who had been interning in Jacksonville at the Times Union this summer, who an entire family was on the roof of the car as rescue workers were gathered around it. And it was hard to tell that it was flood water because the water was moving, so it almost looked like, sea water. And those first photographs to come out sort of told you, if you were experienced at looking at hurricane pictures, that this was a really bad storm.
Mm.
The first really compelling images to come out in the daylight after the storm, I think, were by Vincent LaForte of the New York Times, who somehow managed to get onto a FEMA helicopter and make one of the first air trips over the city. Mm. His photographs were really the first indication of that this was no regular hurricane aftermath. This was a massive disaster.
By the way, his work is online at the New York Times multimedia gallery that they have. He also has his own website, which we'll link listeners to. But can you describe one, Don, that comes to mind, one of Vincent LaForte's pictures?
He shot incredible photographs for two or three straight days, but the picture that really sticks in my mind was from later in the story when he went out to the Louis Armstrong Airport that had been turned into a triage center. And critically ill and dying elderly patients had been transferred there and set up in a makeshift MASH hospital. And he had a photograph of elderly men and women that were basically just stacked around the baggage carousels and stretched out on the floors, really not on any padding or anything.
Yeah, I don't have it in front of me, but I remembered it absolutely. In particular, one stick-thin old woman with white or graying hair and sunken eyes, and she was lying on the conveyor belt, sort of looking into his lens. I remember that, and it just looking right into our eyes through him. That
also, Reuters photographer Rick Wilking, who's used to be a Reuters photographer in Europe and is now a freelancer in the States who shoots for Reuters, he was outside the Superdome when things got really bad, and there's a very compelling photograph he shot of a large African-American man who's cradling a tiny baby in his arms, who's very gently taking a quilt or a blanket and covering up the body of a older man who's died and been sitting in the chair dead for two or three days. And it's just conditions that I don't think Americans have seen before, you know, in this country.
There are
and
some
moments after Rick shot that picture, I read one report that said a bottle of milk whizzed by his head that someone had thrown at him because they didn't, you know, approve of him shooting the photographs.
Well, I want to ask you about that. I mean, how are photographers faring that you know? Because these are such naked pictures.
Well, they are, and it's an urban warfare zone, or it was there for a period of days. I think it's calmed down significantly now. But you've got people who've lost everything. They've been days without food. They have dehydrated children. They're facing an uncertain future, and they may or may not appreciate the role that the media plays in documenting this scene to the world. You're in a situation where the looters could turn against you, the refugees, the victims of the storm could turn against you, the police who are armed can turn against you, and you're sort of not in any of those camps at all, but on your own. And this is why many professionals and many journalism professors and many people in the industry actively discouraged student photojournalists from rushing to the scene.
Well, Don, since we're talking about the photographs, there were two that popped up on the Internet. I'm sure you were aware of the hue and cry over what many people thought were racist captions on two photos. One showed a black man wading through water carrying something, and the caption said that he had looted a store. The other showed a white couple wading through water with bread and milk. the caption said they found Bread and Milk. It turned out they were two completely different agencies that these photos were from, and so it wasn't one agency characterizing the same kind of thing in two different ways. But can you speak to, you know, these things are going into papers quickly, the captions are going up quickly?
Well, in a situation like this, just the way it works is a photographer out on the scene with a digital camera shoots a picture, pulls it into his or her laptop, writes a caption on it, and either dials up to the internet or a satellite phone and sends it back to a desk operation somewhere in a news bureau. An editor there reviews the caption before the caption and the picture are sent out on the satellite network to clients. And for the most part, you take the photojournalist's word, and if you can have a conversation with them to verify it, but for the most part, you take the photojournalist at their word in the caption that this is true and accurate. And there's been some discussion about looting versus finding. And I know I've read online that the National Association of Black Journalists has put out some guidelines this week on use of terms that can be stereotyping. And the photographer who wrote that those people found food has stood by the caption and saying that they found food. I guess, you know, they didn't actually go into a physical location to get it, but they found it either floating or out.
Mm. The pictures that are coming to mind, a shot of a woman's waterlogged hands, the faces that we've seen. My favorite, because it's so bittersweet, a 5-year-old little girl who is black holding the hand of a 105-year-old woman who's white as she's the woman wheeled in a wheelchair out of the Superdome, convention center. Maybe.
The child is the daughter of the adult caretaker that has been caring for the elderly woman who's in the wheelchair.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yes. And it's a poignant scene in that they are, by economics and circumstance, a non-traditional family unit that's fleeing that disaster together.
There's another, and some say this is the photo that might be the iconic one. It is the grave of Vera?
Yes. A woman's body had been on this ground for several days, and no one had taken it away, and someone covered it with a sheet or a tarp, stacked bricks around the edge of the sheet or tarp and to sort of entomb her on the sidewalk, put up a makeshift cross, and either hand-painted or spray-painted on the top, here lies the body of Vera.
We understand she was Elvira Smith. She was killed on Monday by a hit-and-run driver as she walked to a store to find food.
Yes. And, you know, we won't know yet. It's too early to know what the iconic image is going to be that comes out of this story because we haven't seen all the photographs yet. And this is a story that's not over just because it's a week and a half later. This is a story that's going to go on for decades.
Donald Winslow is editor of News Photographer magazine. He's been speaking to us about the photographs that have come from Hurricane Katrina from some very brave photographers. Donald, thank you.
Thank you.
And to see the photos, go to our website, here-now.org. For accompaniment, we offer Randy Newman's Louisiana 1927 about the great flood of that year. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. Please join us again.
What has happened down here is the wind had changed. Clouds roll in from the north and it starts to rain. Rained real hard to rain for a real long time. 6 feet of water in the streets of Evangeline. River rose all day, the river rose all night.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
River has busted. Down to Plaquemine.